Good afternoon. Welcome to the School for Successful Ranching. My name is Logan Papinchak, and I'll be moderating this session today. At this time, I would ask that you place all your cell phones on silent and remove your hats. There's a table in the back of the room where you can place your hats. We would like to take this time to thank our generous sponsors of the School for Successful Ranching for their support of this program and commitment to producer education. They have small displays set up in the hallway on this floor, and we ask that you visit their booths in the expo and say thank you. We could not do this program without them. Sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Cattlemen's Education Series, Corteva, Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Positive Feeds, Rabo Agrifinance, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance. Our next presentation is a panel discussion titled Make or Save Money with Better Practical Pasture Management. We'll let our speakers introduce themselves and tell you about their backgrounds. Please help me in welcoming them.
Good afternoon, everybody. I sure do appreciate you all coming. I know that you had several different options to go to this afternoon, and we definitely think you came to the right one. So my name is Chad Cummings. I am a field scientist with Corteva AgriScience, and I am joined today by four fantastic gentlemen up here who are from various parts of the state and are going to talk a little bit about their own ranching operations as we get into it. Before we get started, many of you may not exactly recognize the name Corteva AgriScience, so I wanted to spend just a brief moment and tell you about who we are. About 2015, Dow Chemical and DuPont merged together to form one company. And over the course of the next 3 to 4 years, we are going to become Corteva AgriScience. We are in the marketplace right now as such, and we will officially be a standalone company as of June of 2019. So with the new company, that brings together the strength of DuPont Crop Protection, DuPont Pioneer, and Dow AgriSciences, who many of you are familiar with from this marketplace in the recent past. You'll notice from that purpose statement on the screen, one of the things that is most important with this new company is that we're really thinking about the producer and the consumer and how we're going to benefit those folks for years to come and generations to come. We're excited about that. We have fantastic innovation going on. And one of the things that we're really focusing on now, we have focused on in the past as well, is building this relationship together and building this strength together. This panel is just a little bit of that evidence right now. We're going to get feedback from you all, and we're going to learn some things from these folks about things that they're doing in their practices to really beef up their bottom line and their return on investment. So the question of the day was basically, in our operations, what pasture practices have made or saved us the most money? And gear that toward the return on investment that we put into any of those certain practices. So in this session, we're going to explore that. We're going to get the panelists' views, and then hopefully we'll have about 20 to 30 minutes at the end for y'all to briefly go through and ask questions to the panelists themselves. So without any further ado, I'll introduce the panelists. Jason Bagley is from the Navasota Ranch here right next to me. He actually grew up in Idaho on a dairy and beef operation, has moved around the country a little bit, going to several different ranches, and landed here in Limestone County and has been a rancher here for quite some time. The Navasota Ranch has basically 3,400 cows and 6,000 stockers when fully stocked, and they calve in September and wean in June on mostly improved forages and some native improved mix. Stephen Diebel, next person over, second from my left, is located down in Victoria County. Stephen has graduated from Texas A&M and has been in the ranching industry for quite some time, and the family as well. Very involved in the board of directors for the TSCRA and chairing the Natural Resources and Wildlife Committee. And so he's actually taking a little bit of time away from them today to join us, so we're very thrilled to have him here. And third over to the left is James Henderson. James has a BS in Animal Science from Texas A&M, and their ranch is located in Donley and Childress counties, live right outside of Memphis, and really involved in the Angus Associations, currently serving on the boards of several of those committees, and running about 500 cows and selling about 300 bulls per year. Of course, that's a different region than many of the others that I've just stated before, moving out toward that mix to short grass prairie. And so they come up with several different environmental conditions that we don't normally see other places in the state. I do want to also point out that James and his family ranch were Environmental Stewardship Award Program winners back in 2008. Finally, but definitely not least, is Brian Morris with the EG Cattle Company. Brian grew up in Seymour, Texas, right near Wichita Falls, has a BS from Texas Tech and then also a ranch management degree from TCU, currently serving as the TCU Ranch Management Alumni President, and lives in Fannin County up in northeast or north central Texas, depending on where you're from, and manages a cow-calf operation on improved forages mostly, a little bit of native as well, and works with the Edwards family out of the Fort Worth area here. That area, of course, is very different from where he grew up, and I think that brings to this panel a very good perspective of what he came from and also what he's looking forward to. So within the course of this panel discussion, we basically developed a survey that we sent to the panelists, and we asked them the same question that was proposed earlier. So as you can see on the slide to my left, we have about four or five different responses that were most picked between these individuals. And let me preface this by saying we didn't give them any guidelines. We just said what practices are working best for y'all. So as you can see, rotational grazing or grazing deferment came up first. Brush and weed control came up second. And then water development, soil sampling, and a whole list of others came up toward the end there. Really encouraging that many of us are thinking about grazing management. I think that's why many of you are here today. And I think we're going to get to learn a little bit more about that. So what I would like to do is now open it up for some discussion with the panelists. I've asked each one of the panelists to discuss one of these items as it relates to their operation, and then integrating some of those others as we think about return on investment and how those practices increase their bottom line. So I'm going to start out with James Henderson and have James talk a little bit about how rotational grazing and grazing deferment are utilized on his operation there in Memphis and Conley County.
Something that's new or something that just came along, but I don't know how well it's been adopted over the years. Those of you that know anything about me and our family situation, my mother-in-law is Minnie Lou Bradley. And Minnie Lou would tell you the story that a few years ago she had a range person come through the ranch, and after he toured the ranch, he told her that was the most understocked, overgrazed ranch he'd ever been on. Now, any of you that know Minnie Lou know that was not acceptable to talk about. And so we embarked on a mission at that point in time to figure out what was wrong. And at that point in time, that was 150 cow ranch. That was all it had ever run. It was the most that it could ever run. And it was pretty severely overgrazed. Today, after going through a number of things that these guys will talk about as well, we're running about 550 cows plus 300 yearling bulls on that ranch, and we have more grass than we've ever had. So managing systems, we began first with trying to defer some pastures. We took some areas that improved grass. We cut that up into some areas that we could rotate through in the growing season, pull all of the cows off of all the native pasture the entire growing season, deferred those pastures, we went in and we reseeded grass, we did all kinds of things to control weeds primarily, but also brush, and we've gotten much more intensive in the brush management as we've gone along. But by deferring those pastures and using grazing where we needed to control some things. So sometimes, you know, it's not a set system. And that's the one thing I will tell you. There's probably two things to remember in a pasture rotation system. Is whatever you lay out first is probably not going to work. And don't get stuck in, I'm going to do this for set periods of time. Let your country and your grass tell you and your cattle tell you how to manage those grasses and how to work them in that system. The other thing that you have to understand that you'll hear more about is water. When you start to throw cattle together, it's one thing, you may have water situated for the number of cattle that you typically run in a pasture. You start to throw them all together and all of a sudden water becomes extremely critical. And so having water storage and water capacity for large numbers of animals when you put them together is a big deal. Out in our part of the world, that's a real big deal because we don't have any ground storage of water. It's all in tanks of some kind that we have. And so that water storage is extremely important. But being able to move those cattle around, control weeds, take old forage off when we need to take old forage off of country, allowing grasses to grow. You know, one of the things that was one of those first things I learned in being on a plant identification judging team was whatever you have above the ground is a reflection of what you have below the ground. And so that ranch that we're on out there was when it was bought in 1955, it was short grass country. You know, and if you have grass this tall, guess what? You have roots that long in that country. If you allow grass to grow, today most of that grass on our ranch would be, we love to talk about being stirrup tall. Sometimes it takes a short horse to get it stirrup tall, but we try to get the grass there and have roots that reflect that kind of growth. And that's our thought process, is being able to always make sure that we get enough growth in the grass that we have root systems to survive in the times. Because as I hear the talk amongst a lot of you here, the amount of rainfall that you've had this year, I've been out there 25 years. Some of you have had more rain this year than we've had in 25. You know, and so it's a little different environment of what we're dealing with out there. But if we can get roots down 3 feet, our grasses can survive nearly anything. From July 1st of 2010 to May the 20th of 2012, we had a total of 9 inches of rain. And in 2011, we didn't have one green day at all. We had 110 days over 100 degrees and 45 days over 110, and those grasses survived. A lot of the trees do, but the grasses survived. And so it's amazing how resilient that country can be, but it takes a lot of management in trying to be able to move those around, rotate through those. But it's more a system of designing places to go with the cattle where you have water and can manage them, and then work through a system of when the cows and the grasses tell you, then you need to move to the next place and move along. So we'll have some more discussion, I'm sure.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, James. I was just going to say we'll keep on cruising here. The next topic that I wanted to discuss real briefly was brush control, and I've asked Jason Bagley to discuss that real briefly and how they're using that on the Navasota Ranch, knowing that each one of these individuals could definitely talk to that point as well. So, Jason, if you don't mind, talk to us just briefly about how you're using brush control to help your bottom line.
Okay. So my first experience with brush control, I was visiting with a guy from Texas when we lived in Florida, and we were comparing. We had wax myrtle down there I was fighting, and after talking to this guy from Texas for about 20 minutes, I looked at him and says, man, I'm glad I'll never have to deal with mesquite. And we moved to Texas about 6 months later, so never say never. So when we got here, as a lot of Texas, mesquites are number one brush problem we have, and it's one thing that's always there. We've got pastures that are really clean, but if we were to just leave them alone 10 years from now, they would be infested with mesquite again. And so as we looked at this property, we try to come up with a long-term plan of how often do we need to keep this pasture sprayed, and what's our cheapest way of keeping this mesquite in control. And we looked at three main options, and one of them would be IPT, individual plant treatment, or works really well if you have a very sparse population of mesquite that you can send a the poor guy out there with a hand wand and spray each tree individually. We contract that out. I can't get my guys to do that very well. That we look at that way, and then we look as those mesquite populations get a little bit thicker, it's probably more economic to use either a ground rig or a helicopter and airplane and an aerial applicate those trees. And then the third option would be your mechanical with either a dozer or a track hoe. And as we looked at that, and we've been out there about 4 years now, our thought was if we've got to doze it today, 5 years from now, we probably still have to doze it. And so we focused on our more open country. And we go across the ranch, and we want to spray about 5,000 to 6,000 acres a year. And our goal is to keep our country that's open, open, and not let the mesquite reinfest and cost us a lot of money. And so that's been our goal so far. We haven't done a lot of mechanical on the ranch yet. And so one of the first things we did is I actually brought Dylan out to the ranch and to help me learn about mesquite and what we do. And we came to the conclusion the first year that we were going to try some aerial application of Sendero. And so we sprayed it. And the next year I noticed a lot of green leaves coming back, and I was a little bit concerned about that. So I brought Dylan back out and said, hey, I thought this Sendero was supposed to kill this stuff. And as we drove around the pasture, we noticed there was a lot of damage in those leaves still occurring the second year. And so it's pretty obvious that the Sendero has, it takes a couple years, and that has some residual effect for a couple years in those trees. That same pasture, we ended up spraying it twice. I also learned that time that you got to make sure your trees are healthy to do that. And we aim for, and it's different everywhere, but we aim for spraying in July when it's hot, but before the trees will start to yellow. So if we can see a dark green tree, it's hot, so it's pulling a lot of its reserves back to the roots. We have our best luck killing that mesquite. And in that first year, we were past that a little bit. The trees were a little yellow, and so I ended up having to spray that one twice. And we wound up with about a 40% control in that pasture the first year, which is not very acceptable. But the second time around, and I'll know this summer how well we did the second time around, but it was a good lesson for me to learn that you've got to be willing to say if those trees aren't ready, to let it go for a year and to wait till the conditions are just right so your chemical has the best chance of being your most effective. Even with that Sendero, and these Corteva guys may differ from this, but from what I've read, it's about, if things are ideal, you're about 75% control. And for us, it's about $30 to $60 an acre to do an aerial application. And if you look at IPT, we can get about a 90% control if things are right. And that one is ranged on the ranch anywhere from about $30 to about $120 an acre. And as I look at that across the ranch, as we drive around and make our plan for the year, what we're going to spray, I look at those stands and see what I should do. And it's kind of a guessing game, but look, that passion say we can probably IPT that for about 30 to 50. We'll pull the trigger and do that. If it's going to be 70 or 80, I'm probably better off to using a helicopter or a ground rig and spraying that brush. And then beyond that, if you get in mechanical, I know some of the thick country, you're in several hundred dollars an acre. And so our whole goal is to get the ranch in what we call a maintenance program, is that the mesquite are small, they're not big trees, that we can go across really quick with an IPT crew and keep it on control. And so that's our goal right now on the ranch, is to get the ranch on the IPT program. We're probably 2 or 3 years out before we get it there, and hopefully we'll be successful with that.
Fantastic, Jay. Thank you very much. The third item on the list was actually weed control. And while those sometimes go in concert, it's not a constant that they always will be done together, especially when you have a geography like northeast Texas where we don't have a huge number of mesquite in that area. And a lot of times we're having to concentrate on the weeds as well. So I've asked Brian Morris with the Edwards Cow Company to talk just a little bit about what they're doing in regard to weed control on their ranch.
Go work this time. If you can hear me all right. Thank you all for having me. Like Chad said, I live in northeast Texas, about an hour and a half northeast of Dallas. I grew up in Seymour. I still call that North Texas. But anyways, it's a more native grass, a lot of wheat pasture. And when I moved to northeast Texas there in Fannin County, it's mostly introduced grasses, Bermuda grass being, and it's a coastal hybrid. and a little bit of hay and some other grasses. But it's a totally different part of the world. We have one mesquite tree, which is a blessing, and we blame a horse for that. But anyways, I went from battling mesquite or learning about mesquite growing up around it to now not having any. And one of my biggest challenges as far as production in grass is one particular weed, and it's croton, woolly croton. And it's probably one of the easiest weeds to kill. But the ranch, when I first got there, had not been sprayed in a few years. It had been sprayed in the past, but they'd been shredding. And I looked at that. I'm not really a big fan of equipment. It was pretty expensive for us to shred. The shredding actually, in my opinion, cost us one application of shredding was more than one application of spreading. I mean, any type of herbicide. So to properly control the weeds, we would have to shred it twice. We're also taking out grass production every time we shredded. So we looked at our options. I went and searched through different chemical companies and everybody to find somebody. They put me in touch with, at the time, a Dow representative, Brent Mettler. And anyways, he came out to the ranch a couple of times and drove across the ranch and every pasture. He spent a lot of time with me and really straightened me out and helped me come up with a prescription, what I need to do. And I started out with Grazon Next. And I had a lot of Carolina horse nettle and some nightshades, a lot of weeds that are at the time also harder to kill. And so I did exactly as they told me. And I talked to several other people and got the same opinion from everyone. I stayed with Grazon Next for 3 years on all my open pastures that had Bermuda grass on them. And I really do not have a nightshade or anything in that family problem at all. I have a few spots that end up with them. But I stayed with that for 3 years, and my plan was, I thought, well, I'll spray this for 3 years, and I'll be able to lay off my weed control for a while. And I've learned that probably wasn't going to happen. So I went from an area where I could handle the amount of weeds I had with the grazing pressure or my pasture management to an area where I have to spray to keep the croton out so I can have grass and it doesn't shade the grass. The croton that we have is a giant woolly croton, and it will... I've literally seen it to the top of where the window starts on a four-wheel drive pickup. So it gets very big, and it shades, has a lot bigger stem than what the dove weed or goat weed that I grew up around in Seymour. So it was a challenge to figure out, you know, how to spray it and also kill the other weeds. It doesn't sometimes sprout until, if we get a good rain here at the end of June, we might have a sprout. So that's my target. I try hitting into May. I'm watching the pastures, and in June, I'm probably spraying the first week of June or last week of May, depending on the croton. That's what I watch. And I want residual out there, and residual is very important for me. I do it in one application, and I take care of the problem. But Corteva now has been very... very vital in my role as far as figuring out what I need to do. The range and pasture department helps. Chad doesn't live very far from me now either. But anyways, they've been a great help for me. I think cattle production and herbicides go hand in hand when you're on a Bermuda grass situation like I am. I would love it to where I didn't have to spray, but I find that it's a necessity for me. I know the easiest way to save some money is to not spend it, but if you don't spend money in the places it's needed, there'll be a time that you'll be in a financial crisis because of that. So,
now, Brian, you touched just briefly early on about shredding versus spraying, and I know a lot of our country in the eastern half of Texas, maybe even a little bit more, loves to run that shredder, right? But you talked a little bit about the fact that takes away forage as well, not just the weeds. Can you talk just a little bit more to that or what you saw when you did try shredding some?
Yeah, in my opinion, when you ran a shredder across the ground, and I'll step on some toes, but there's some different theories on shredding. One of them, you could just shred once all the weeds are above the grass. Another one is you could shred early as soon as you start to see weeds in the grass. If you do that, then you will be shredding the second time if you want to control things like croton that I have. So you've got two passes across with a mower. We'll just call it a mower, and you're basically mowing your yard. And In my opinion, when a shredder goes across it, you've taken more grass probably you did than with one rotation of the cows through there, or yearlings, whatever you had. So, I mean, it's just obvious looking at to me that the grass production was being hurt by using a shredder. I could spend less money by using a herbicide in one application than I did with one pass with a shredder and not lose any grass production. So that was a financial, I think, win as far as that spraying versus shredding for me.
Helping that bottom line out a little bit. Very good. Thank you very much, Brian. And last but not least, we're going to have Stephen talk a little bit about another topic that James also commented on, and that's water distribution or water development. So, Stephen, how does that really help you guys in save and or make money in your operations?
Sure, you bet. Well, my name is Stephen Diebel, and we ranch down there on the coast in Victoria. For those of you who had watched the news a year and a half ago, Hurricane Harvey kind of sat right on top of Victoria and our ranching area. And it's kind of ironic that we speak of water development and the water importance of these grazing systems. You know, one thing that James touched on, grazing is sometimes it's supposed to be a science, but in my opinion, it's more of an art. And one of the tools that we have in our toolbox is to provide good water distribution. In our area, usually livestock will not go over a quarter of a mile outside of a watering situation. James touched on also the volume of water that needs to be allocated to these grazing units based on the number of animal units in those grazing systems. And so there's several details that we need to focus on when we install these watering systems. The hurricane through our part of the world, we were very reliant on windmills for many, many years. And as we have grown through our ranching operation, the reliance on these windmills and finding individuals that repaired these became a very financial, a big financial burden. So we've gone mostly to solar systems with large storage devices and a lot of pipelines. We used to take care of 35 to 40 windmills, and now we're in a situation where we're managing 5 to 10 solar units, depends on which ranch we're at, and we have a lot of pipelines in the ground. And all those pipelines and storage systems and pumping plants are all based on herd sizes that we have. We try to have at least one herd, five pasture rotation. Sometimes it's one herd up to 10 or 12 pastures. Grazing deferment is a huge thing for us. We're in an area where we'll get 38 to 40 inches. This fall we were Labor Day to Christmas, we got in the 80-inch rainfall. So with regards to water distribution and water development, we just feel like it's a really key component to establishing these grazing management and grazing systems. So with that said, it's allowed us to be much more efficient with our repairs. We don't have to repair the windmills that we used to have to go repair twice a year. Now these solar units have become very, very reliable and very cost efficient, in my opinion, where we've not had to allocate any repair costs to a system that may be 5 or 6 years old. So that's a little bit in a nutshell on my thoughts on the water development. But it's in my opinion it's a very crucial part of our grazing systems, because without it, we can't maintain those grazing systems, we can't defer, and we can't allow these pastures to recover from the grazing that we've had. So very important aspect of rotational grazing.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Stephen.
You bet.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for all those perspectives, and I will say that I appreciate all the comments you made. Those were completely done by the individuals, so I know that those all goes directly to your ranches, but they can also transcend to everybody else's ranches. So now is the funnest part of the day, and I think we'll just go ahead and call it quits from here, because I know nobody in the audience has any questions, right? We can just go home and have a margarita or something. So I will go ahead and open it up for Q&A. Once again, just a reminder, Jason is from the Navasota Ranch, kind of in central Texas. Stephen is down on Victoria on the coastal plain. James is up what I call northwest, but is still probably in the central part of the state up in Childers area. And then Brian is over in the north northeast part of the state. So if you have questions directly to individuals, that's fine. If you want to just open them up to the group as a whole, and we can provide some time for each one of them to comment on, that's fine as well. So you have the first question here. Yes, sir.
Yeah, in regards to waste management, we spend a lot of money on herbicides and labor on that. We started using goats to control that. It seems to be working, and we're only 3 or 4 years into it, and we're considering some sheep also to just kind of complement the cattle. Any of you have experience with that, or have anything to recommend?
And I'll go ahead and repeat the question so everybody in the audience can hear before anybody answers. But the gentleman basically asked, he's utilizing goats and now somewhat sheep to do some of his brush control, and wondered if any of the panelists had any experience using some of those other livestock animals.
Chad, as I said, I'm a different generation than these other guys, but I was raised in the hill country in the 60s, and there were a lot of sheep and goats in the hill country in that time period, and that is the way we managed both brush and forage at that time, was with sheep and goats and basically running cattle behind them. So I think if you can manage predators, which today that is the big problem in dealing with sheep and goats, is managing the predators, that's not a bad way to do that. But I know that my dad, before he passed away the last couple of years, just in Eagles, he was losing about 50% of his lamb and kid crop. That didn't count coyotes and other things. That was just Eagles. So predators are a real big problem in dealing with that.
Fantastic question. Yes, sir.
Steve?
Yes, sir.
You wanted to try, we put up a solo unit of well.
Yes, sir.
We have problems finding someone to put it up. Do you find it difficult to find people to maintain it if you need to have a pump out from another one put in or anything like that?
And I'll repeat that question real quick. The question was to Stephen in regard to the solar units that he's using, and if when repairs are necessary, if he has trouble finding folks to be able to do that in his area.
I've not experienced that problem. Our water well repair guys in our area, those that had fixed our windmills, a lot of those guys are having to transition and maybe not so much learn a new trade, but they're having to go to some of these alternative systems that we feel like are much more economical for. So I've not experienced that problem. We'll use a variety of systems. I think there's 3 or 4 systems out there that have kind of risen to the top with regards to dependability. But all the guys typically that we use can perform those basic needs. We've had solars probably for 6 or 8 years now, and we've not experienced any pump failures yet. So with that said, maybe I'm not quite to your point, but there are individuals that I felt like have been able to repair those.
Very good. I'm going to...
When we were in the ground, we were looking for an alternative. Our tank dried up, and it was like pulling the hen teeth trying to find someone who would be able to do that. Eventually, we found someone from El Dorado, Texas, to come to do that for us. And we haven't looked for anybody else. It's still working. So I'm looking at,
sure,
if it goes bad, you know, would be a difficult problem finding somebody from bed.
Those solar systems are typically pretty simple. And so, I mean, a lot of the things that go wrong with a solar system you can fix yourself. Typically, and now we're in a lot tougher water area than theirs are. A solar pump in our area, if it has a 36-month guarantee, it'll go out in 38. You know, we've dealt with a lot of that over the years, but I agree. I mean, nearly anybody that does well service today is going to be working with solars as well.
Very good. I want to take just a brief break, And just to get to know our audience, how many of you would consider yourself new operators with 5 years or less in the industry? Raise your hands. Okay, and then the rest of you, I'm assuming, will have 5 years or more. Is that correct? Raise your hand. Very good. Okay, so a mix of both. Thank you very much. We'll go back to answering some questions. Yes, sir, in the blue shirt in the back. So the question was basically, have we found, or has Brian found in his geography, an optimum timing to spray so that you don't have to end up doing it again, correct? Is that, yes, sir.
I think that's a moving target year to year, finding the right time to spray, probably with brush and everything, but probably late would be the best answer. You have to use more money and more chemical, but that way you wouldn't have to respray. That's what I'm watching every day when the croton, like I said, that's my latest weed that I really combat. There's some early weeds that do cause more trouble every year, it seems like. I'll probably have to cross that road when I get there, but right now they're not a challenge. So I'm watching the croton, and when it starts to get to a certain height, usually if it's below 6 inches, I can kill it very easily. That's the way of saving money is keeping the rate with the label, the lowest rate I can use on croton. Most labels, and correct me if I'm wrong, on woolly croton is probably one of your lower rated weeds as far as how much of the chemical it takes to kill it. So I'm using the lowest label rate probably on everything I would use. So that's just a moving target. And maybe being able to withstand a little bit of regrowth in the latter part of the year. If you know, every year is different. You get a light summer rain that just sparks some more croton up. You got some sandier soils and some disturbed areas, you're going to have it. And, we're in an area where we don't have a lot of brush except around creeks and in timber areas. So what we're spraying with is typically a ground rig, which has got 90-foot booms. And so it's pretty open area. And I don't want to take that piece of equipment back across, a second time. So I've been fairly lucky, and I've what I've had regrowth as far as spraying 1st of June, I've not had to go back a second time for the croton.
Yes, sir. Over here. The question was, have you all had any success battling Weesatch?
I'll talk about that one. Weesatch is our nemesis on the coast, and it's probably one of the worst invasive species that I've personally been around. Our landscape has changed. This is something we talk about in our grazing coalition meetings all the time. Our approach to Weesatch is much, much different than it was 5 years ago. Our approach to Weesatch and brush control, we are now going with a 3-year suppression spray. We've got so many different obstacles on the coast. We've got hurricanes and floods and droughts and everything in between, cotton. So our methodology is to spray when we can spray, and we like to do it on a 3-year rotation. And we'll use some of those lower-rate chemistries, Nex being one of them, coupled with a couple other products. And we will spray those, and sometimes year one we'll do a, if we're talking aerial spraying, and I know that may not be applicable to everybody, we'll spray the entire pasture, and then we'll come back year two and year three and skip spray, which cuts our cost in half. But we've been employing some of those more strategic forage production type sprays, in other words, doing those mainly in the spring, April, May, June time frame, if cotton's not an issue. And we've just we've kind of focused our attention not on brush mortality, but on forage production, and that's what keeps us in business. So whatever you can do to accomplish the forage production side, I think at the end of the day, you're going to have some brush effects. So it's kind of a different philosophy, but it's a philosophy that, number one, we can stay in business. We found that the really expensive sprays doing it, once every 5 years, WESATCH will, it'll be above and beyond. So we have to employ some suppression techniques and some of those things like fire and all those things in the toolbox that'll allow us to grow grass. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I can give you some specific mixes that we use. But Grazon Next is a key component to that. Absolutely, you bet.
Yes, sir, right here.
I'd like to know what kind of forages you use or utilize in your areas, and any grasses or other forages. If you use winter forages or grazing, what you can plant measures.
Okay.
What works for y'all?
So the question was basically in regard to what forage bases each one of these individuals use across the different geographies. So if we want to just go down the line, we can start with Jason and kind of discuss what he's using there in Central Texas.
So there in Central Texas, we initially had a plan of planting a lot of Bermuda grass onto the ranch. And after trying to get established and failing a lot of times, we pulled that way back. And we implemented an intensive grazing system where we run herds of about 500 head, and we rotate about every 3 or 4 days, again, depending on what the grass says and what the cows say. And what we've noticed is, I'm going to say it native. In my country, it was all cotton fields in the early 1900s, and so it's not really true native grass, but a lot of KR blue stem and things like that. I've noticed a big response in those KR blue stems. We're seeing a lot of silver blue stem come back in, and so that's really our focus now. We've found with the Bermudas, they're great June, July, August, September, and into October. Great forage production, but you also got to feed them. And so fertilizer is expensive, as everybody knows. It's one of the most expensive things we do. And we're seeing with that change in our grazing system, our natives are really responding to that without a drop of fertilizer on it. And so our focus has kind of shifted of planting grass into let's take care of what's out there, and let's graze it right, let's treat it right, and let's get the natives and let them do the job that they can do.
Go ahead. Yeah, to Steve.
We probably 60%, and we run a cow-calf operation and a stocker in a preconditioning program. So 60% of our cow herd will calve between January and March 1, and then our fall calving season is September 1 to about the second week in November. So we have pretty defined calving seasons. But to answer your question with regards to forage, we really try to match our peak milk yield of these cows, of these animal units, to our forage production systems. We have probably in our operation, it's probably 60% native, 30 to 40% introduced grasses. We really don't like to rely on fertility. Fertility is expensive, just as equipment is. And my opinion, our input costs are what we have to really, really pay attention to. So I think it's more an adaptive art of our grazing management and getting these herds in compliance with our forage production and the timing of the year and timing your calving seasons and those sorts of things. So that's what's really been beneficial for us.
Our native pasture up there would be a lot of grama grasses, primarily silos and blue grama, some hairy grama that we would have. A number of tall grasses, big blue stem, switchgrass, Indian grass, green sprangle top. We'll have a lot of plains bristle grass, so a pretty big variety of native type species of grasses. The improved grasses, which would mostly be old CRP country that was planted in CRP program, would be Old World blue stem primarily, some Beedall blue stem in some of that, and those would be the ones that we typically intensively graze in the summertime. Would be those forages and keep those native pastures for fall and winter grazing for us. But as far as we don't get enough rainfall typically to do cool season forages. We're going to try to plant some Indivite Creek fescue this fall and attempt to do some of that, but wheat's good for us about once every 10 years. So
northeast Texas there, so primarily Bermuda grass is what was there, coastal Bermuda. I will speak on our cultivated pastures or fields. We usually do not have a crop for harvest, but we have wheat to graze. Of course, I grew up in Seymour, so my first go-to is wheat. But something I've done differently is trying to find something to also be a warm season on those pastures that are cultivated. And what I've done, I'm not harvesting, keep in mind, my wheat, but I've put in some Red River crabgrass, and it's very easy to put in, low expense, and I put those across the wheat fields and don't have to fertilize them. Maybe need some to scratch the ground a little bit, some type of tillage to get them to sprout up, but some very good grazing. I really wanted to go with, I grew up around Sudan hay grazers, and we have a sugarcane aphid problem, so I've avoided that, which I think has been a good thing for me. Crabgrass I hadn't had to replant, so it's there. May have to put a little more seed out in a few years, but I hadn't had to yet. So.
Well, I just looked down at my watch and noticed that we're having so much fun. We're kind of eating into the break, so if any of you all need to leave, please feel free to do so. Another session will be starting here at 3:30. But what I will also say is, if you all want to stick around a little while, we have a little bit of time yet to answer a couple more questions. But definitely thank you all for your attendance, and we really appreciate everything. Again, not any one of these tools should ever be considered as something that you use alone. I think it's very important that we understand that each one of these ranches are doing things in concert and as a whole, using the entire toolbox in many of their operations. So while each one individual talked about one aspect, please remember to always consider each one of those aspects as you move forward in your operation. So with that, thank you all very much, and hope you have a continued great PSCRA.